find the individual, we can examine them and see the kind of problems arises through that faulty interaction. We've already divided the being up into three parts. The orthodox terms for the drive part, its culmination, for the feeling part, affection, and for the idea part, either ideation or cognition. Ideation itself, and that's called ideation. Ideation itself is a process simply of formal presentation. It can be serial, and it need not fit itself as it's going on. It need not be consistent. In fact, most frequently it isn't. It's just a serial presentation of forms at the mental level. The word idea is the Greek word for form, and form is the Latin word for shape, and shape is the Saxon word for idea. And if we say that the shapes of things depend entirely on the mode of circumscription, in any shape, form, or idea, we are concerned with some finite, something with a limiting factor, a binding contour. And according to the way this contour wiggles about, you recognize a given form or shape or idea. It doesn't matter how you bend it, you get a piece of string, wiggle it about, and the two ends tied together. As long as the ends are tied together and there's some space between it, there is a binding contour and a contained form. You might have seen a card that children play with, and it has a piece of loose chain on it, and the drawing of the back of a man's head, and then you shake the card, and the chain wiggles about and produces funny caricatures. All the time the chain on the card is bound into a circle, but the way you shake it makes it produce different types of form, individuals. And we can say in exactly the same way, every living being starts from an egg, a sphere, and this sphere is the type of being. In fact, it is the original form of the letter B, which is a circumscribing letter used to signify being itself. And then every individual recognizably different from another individual can be considered simply as a distortion of the primary sphere of being. So it's insofar as we differ from each other, and from this prime spherical shape, we can claim to be distorted. If we look then at the idea level, we're looking at the level at which we are conscious of circumscribed forms or shapes. We derive these primarily from the visual sense, because it is the eye that photographs the contours of objects as presented by light, by reflected light, in the case of light hitting a surface, or by direct light impeded by an interposing obstacle, which we then see in silhouette. If you see a tree against the horizon at evening, with the light behind it, the light is coming directly into your eye, and the shape of the tree is impeding it and standing out as a silhouette. You're getting direct light into your eye, and the silhouette of the tree is blocking it. On the other hand, if you look at the tree with the light on it, you are seeing it by reflected light. The tree is throwing the light into your eye. The sun may be behind your head, and the light of it is hitting the tree and bouncing into your eye. So you can see by reflected light or by direct light. But in either case, you are seeing a binding contour. And this binding contour and its peculiar characteristics are what we mean by idea. And we recognize one idea from another idea simply by the particular mode of its formation. In fact, when we say define a term, define an idea, we mean indicate the particular peculiar modes of the shape of the contour, or the contour of the shape. So at the idea level, all we have actually is a kind of visual image of a circumscribing line, And the way this line is distorted is the so-called individual characteristic of the idea of an examiner. Now, an idea in its abstract form, using abstract in the sense it should be used, that is, taken away, drawn away from the whole concrete reality, the idea abstracted from the emotive level and from the cognitive level is simply a shape which of itself must be considered to be powerless in the abstract sense. The abstract idea is powerless. It is powerless because we have abstracted it. And it is powerless only because we have abstracted it. Real ideas, non-abstract, concrete ideas in the mind, are not powerless because they happen to be packets of energy formulated in certain ways. And they are behaving and driving about in the mind. They are making their own associations with each other, quite independently of the so-called individuality, which in any case is just a simple complex of ideas. So, when we talk about idea in the abstract sense, we are talking about the kind of shape we get with a visual impression, whether by direct light, as we see a silhouette, or by reflected light, as when the sun shines onto an object and then the object reflects the light into our eye. And when we think of idea in its abstract sense, we are deliberately eliminating the affective or feeling correspondent and also the cognitive or drive urge which normally accompanies it. Now, by repeated inhibition of feeling and drive, of the affective and cognitive responses, we have gained the power, sufficiently to dupe ourselves, of separating the form of the situation from the affective, emotional, and drive responses. In so doing, we have created an abstract world of ideas which we erroneously believe stands still and does nothing unless we push it about. If we remember that an idea, in fact, is a definite amount of energy which has gone into our substance, has formulated itself within our substance, has got its tail in its mouth and is now spinning about in a peculiar characteristic mode of its own, and by means of its own resonance, its frequency, and its characteristic contours, is very busily, energetically engaged in making associations with other ideas with which its resonance, its frequency will fit, and with which its peculiar characteristic contours have some likeness. At the concrete level, then, an idea is a definite amount of energy with its own feeling, that is, its field round it. Feeling is what we experience when we directly apprehend the field, and its own tendency to move about, its driving power. That's the idea at the concrete level. But when we're thinking of the idea at the concrete level, we are also thinking of the emotional and primary urge, correspondence and accompaniments of it. And as we say, by abstracting the form of the thing, by deliberately suppressing emotion and cognitive drive, we have managed to deceive ourselves into thinking that ideas as such are powerless. In fact, they have become effectively powerless in many cases. That is to say, many ideas have been completely, for practical reasons, divorced from their corresponding feelings or their corresponding urges. Thus it is possible to talk about largesse or about great-heartedness and so on without feeling as if one has either of these qualities or tendencies. We have gained this power to separate the idea from the emotion and from the cognitive drive. If this separation were really complete, it would be of no damage to us, because all that would happen would be that we would have visual presentations and they would have no effect whatever upon our emotions or our urges. However, the abstract nature of the idea is merely an illusion caused by repressive processes. We see that initially to the baby, the form of the mother, that is the visual image the baby has from the reflection of the light on the mother's face into the eye of the baby, the form of the mother, the idea of the mother, to the child is not yet separated from the sensations of warmth, the sensuous delight in suckling, absorbing milk and so on, and its natural tendency to drive towards the source of its comfort and nourishment. These things for the child are not separated out, they're not analyzed, so that its responses to its mother are threefold. It sees a form, it feels, it urges, simultaneously, non-analytically. We say the child is innocent, it's swallowing the whole of reality at one gulp. But very quickly something happens to stop the child doing this, because the will of the child is that everything shall be pleasant. And it finds, in fact, that sometimes the supply of the milk is unpleasant. Maybe its mother is married and might start shouting at the husband. And this noise might disrupt the hearing mechanism of the child and cause some discomfort. As soon as discomfort arises, then the child tries to avoid the negative emotion from the experience. In other words, it tries to push it out of consciousness. But while it is doing so, it is also trying to retain in consciousness the visual image of the form to be avoided. In other words, we try to sharpen our formal awareness and to get rid of the negative emotions associated with the form we're trying to retain. We want to lose the painful part of the experience and have a very clear image of what caused it so that we can dodge it in the future. So by this process of inhibiting the emotive response and at the same time sharpening the visual image, we manage to give rise to this erroneous idea that ideas of themselves have no emotive charges and are not connected directly with the will. But we do this only at the expense of destroying our basic unity and innocence. Now, in the very, very same way that we can abstract the idea by deliberately suppressing the emotional responses and inhibiting the conative drive, we can also, by the same process, abstract feeling and conation, so that we can squash an idea and retain a feeling that we like or dislike something without being aware formally of what it is we like or dislike. William Blake, not liking Dr. Fell, not knowing why, but still not liking him. In the same way, we can suppress the awareness of the urge, we can stop an urge, we can stop a primary power that's tending to move into the musculature and force action. We can stop it functioning so convincingly that we can deceive ourselves into believing that we have no such urge. There are many urges that are socially unacceptable, and in order to live in society, we ordinarily, and is by order, curb these drives. And because we would be censured if we were to exhibit these drives, in the actual inhibition of them, we also tend to hope that nobody's noticed that we even had a tendency towards it. And to make quite sure they don't notice, the normal reaction is to declare that we have no such drive, that we're not really that kind of person. So not only do we manage to suppress the drive, we also suppress the idea that there is such a drive in us, and by sheer repetition we eventually come to believe we are good boys and girls. That is, socially adjusted people. We can then suppress any two of the three functions and thus focus on the other one, and this one then becomes an abstract. That is to say, it's something taken out of the concrete whole unity of the being, considered as an isolated entity, and a pretense is made that it has no real relation with the other things. We can therefore take an idea, abstract it, throw away the feeling, that is, the field around the idea, and the cognitive drive, that is the charge to action upon the idea, and we can take the shape of the experience and pretend that is an abstract idea with no motive power or emotion itself. In the same way, we can take a feeling, we can deliberately hide the idea that gave rise to it, and we can suppress the drive that will put it into action. Thus we can see that a child who has a feeling that it likes a certain type of lollipop, and it has found that when it expresses this liking, perhaps its mother says you've had enough and stops it. And the mother might notice when the child is tending to the lollipop, and the child will discover that as soon as it starts to move towards it or clearly formulate what it wants, the mother tends to anticipate it and to stop it. So the child then learns not to express to its mother what it wants. It learns to hold in the creative drive towards it and to keep its mouth shut and not to speak about what it wants. But nevertheless, the urge to the lolly is seen in little muscle twitches, and the idea of the lolly is in the eyes staring out. And by this method of suppression of two and the retention of one, we have given birth to three worlds of abstracts. That is, a world of ideas abstracted from feeling and inclination, a world of feeling abstracted from idea and drive. This is the aesthetic world of the arts, and a world of drives abstracted from the aesthetic and ideational sense. And this is the world of delinquents. When we see this, we see that the only way back to our wholeness is to find the missing pair for any one that we're concentrating upon. Now we know it must be there because absolutely we're dealing with power. Matter is power. The behavior of matter is simply the behavior of power. Bodies, material bodies, are bodies of forces. There is nothing absolutely other than power. This power appears in three modes. It appears as shapes, it appears as feelings, and it appears as drives. But it is always this power that is presented either as idea or feeling or drive. The concrete fact behind these three abstract worlds is the fact of directly experienced power. If therefore we have an idea and we feel that this idea is getting a bit abstract, what we have to do is say to ourselves, how do I feel about this idea? Do I like it or dislike it? And further, is there in this idea a drive towards or away from something? Is it destructive or creative? If we actually formulate verbally to ourselves in this way, we can capture the feeling that goes with an idea. We can capture the amount of energy on the idea. And when we say to an idea, what is the feeling of this idea? What we are really doing is saying, what is the form of the situation which, if we put ourselves into, we would derive some degree of pleasure or pain from it. The aesthetic sense is only concerned with pleasures and pains. And that's because, of course, it is primarily a feeling awareness. And feeling only has these two aspects, the aspect of pleasure and the aspect of displeasure. And this depends on the mode of motion of the power, substance. In other words, the ease with which a certain movement is accomplished, the ease with which a certain amount of energy is assimilated into an organism, or the lack of ease, the discomfort, the discord, disharmony of this assimilation process, or perhaps even a complete failure to assimilate. When we then look at an idea, we should ask ourselves, do I like it or don't I? And to do this, we have to see the way this idea fits with a lot of other ideas. And very, very quickly, when we ask ourselves if we like this idea or dislike it, it forces us to consider some other ideas, because all the ideas are really linked together. So the attempt to find out whether we like an idea or not will lead us to to find associations for that idea, and then we discover that the real association factor underlying all association of ideas has always been an emotive field. Something around the idea has caused the idea to link with another one. Now, if you remember Hume's definition of the laws of association, he says the laws of association are first similarity, then contiguity of space and time, and then thirdly causation. Now he is seeing three categories here. Similarity, he means similarity of form or shape. Contiguity, touching together in same place or same time. And causation, which he defined as invariable sequence. Now in fact, these three are one, namely similarity. Similarity of form, similarity of place, similarity of time, similarity of series. There's only similarity that we don't. The same in similarity, of course, means seed, which means potential, which means power. The laws of association are simply the laws of the way power behaves. When power rolls itself up in a certain way, it produces a characteristic idea. And because it is power that is doing so, it is a definite drive to formulate in that way. You can't have this idea without this drive to formulate. Likewise, it is a definite amount of field force that is involved in the idea or form of action into which this drive has put itself. So you cannot have an idea without a cognitive urge or a certain amount of field force involving itself in the idea. When we examine the feeling, if we have a feeling of pleasure or displeasure, and we can't find an idea to account for it, it simply means we're not looking properly. There is one there. And the funny thing is, because feeling is a direct awareness of the state of power in the organism, if we have a feeling, then quietly say to ourselves, what is causing this feeling, and is what is the invariable sequence that leads up to this feeling, that always appears in the mind, after a little waiting, if you don't hammer too hard, a series of ideas or images, an ideational process. And if you then watch it very, very carefully and question each bit as it comes along, saying, do I like you, do I dislike you, then the idea series will give its culprit up. And in the same way, if you find that you have an impulse, a cognitive urge, towards or away from something, and you don't know what's causing it, you might think it's a bit of local tumescence. If you feel very carefully whether you like or dislike it, in the case of the cognitive drive, generally you will find that you feel ambiguous about it. There's obviously something they're demanding to be done, but something is saying don't do it. This is how you know that it's there, because there is a resistance to it. It's a resistance to it that has forced it to become aware of itself. And so there's a peculiar ambiguous Saturn, Jupiter, something about the cognitive urge. In the case of the sexual experience, you know that you experience simultaneously a Saturnine compression and a Jupiteran release simultaneously as pain and pleasure. The point is that as soon as you get hold of this cognitive drive and ask yourself whether you like it, and you feel its ambiguity, and then you switch your attention from the drive to the feeling level of it, if you hold your mind in a relaxed state, images will begin to present themselves, ideas will come into consciousness. You will begin to see a series of situations in which precisely this cognitive drive has appeared before. And the law of the eternal recurrence says that everything is going on all the time. And therefore we know that every form of idea is an eternal. Every feeling of liking, disliking is an eternal correspondent. And every cognitive drive is an eternal power corresponding with that idea. So we see that we have these three levels of being. We see that the danger is of suppressing two and abstracting one, and then assuming that this one has an independent existence of its own, and thus becoming unconscious of the other two elements. We step up, eliminate the other two elements, but leaves us in the dark about their activities. In fact, the basis of modern psychology of the last 60 years is just a restatement of this elementary principle. And where you are unconscious about this threefold activity, you are at the mercy of this activity. Now let's look at our diagram. We put it here very simply. In the middle we've got feeling power, and sort of symbol of the heart round it, which in this case has got broken in the middle. And we've got an arrow going down. We're saying that this feeling power may influence the cognitive power below. We know that if we get into a situation which is pleasurable to us, then the mere fact that it is pleasurable will tend to mobilize the field. Remember, we experience the field as feeling. The pleasure in the feeling will tend to mobilize the field force, and it will become drive. So that if we like a thing, we tend to do it again. So the feeling may influence the cognitive drive below, which means that, say, at the lowest level, the appetite for food can be influenced by feeling. One likes it. And if one likes a certain kind of food, one tends to eat it. If one dislikes it, one tends not to eat it. But in the same way that the feeling can influence the cognitive drive, and the positive feeling of pleasure can release drive power, a negative feeling of dislike can inhibit it. It can cut it off, so that a man who dislikes a certain kind of nose on a face may actually find that his basic urge to food, family, or sex diminishes, or even disappears. And the feeling power can also bias ideas. In other words, pleasure can mislead the reason. It can cause funny kinds of errors in mathematics and logic. Liking a thing can lead us to select those particular ideas out of all the idea plenty we have, which will lead to permission to indulge this particular liking. And disliking an idea can cause the suppression of all those ideas that say this particular thing should be done. Feeling then can bias either for or against mathematics, logic, and geometry. As we say, mathematics and logic and geometry are really the particular studies mainly concerned with form, with ideas. And feeling power can and does influence us and make us ungeometrical, unmathematical, and illogical. So the feeling power can press down and up and influence the drive power and bias the idea power. And if we like to be open, we say it can bias the drive power and influence the idea power. We had a bit of a debate about which word to put where on this diagram. In the same way that the feeling power can work up and cause illogicalities in the arrangement of ideas, or cause negativity or super positivity in the drive centers, so an idea presented, perhaps by an outside stimulus, a simple form, remember, idea is form. Supposing we have an idea in the head of a triangle, and this triangle has been previously immutably biased, and a certain amount of cognitive drive has been released, and the body is now predisposed to do the same thing again, and then out of the corner of one's eye one sees a triangle, perhaps on a lady's hat, which has nothing to do with the original triangle, but it is a triangle. And consequently, this triangle rattles about in the head, stimulates the triangle within, this immediately then may inhibit the feeling power below. The idea may say, no, don't have such feeling. As a matter of fact, it may also say, do have such feeling. But certainly it can interfere with it. Now, you may be feeling very positive about something, which means that you want to do it. But your education, that is the insertion of ideas through your eyes and with correspondent verbal terms through your ears, the presentation of these ideas may say that is not allowed. And when these ideas are presented, they actually have the power to interfere with, to inhibit the feeling. So one feels that although one does like so-and-so and certainly do it, one feels that one should not. And if the tendency to do so is very strong, then one feels the shadow of punishment, which is called guilt. Now, if the idea power inhibits the feeling power and makes the feeling power negative, as the moral idea does in the feeling levels, in thou shalt not have any other gods but me, etc., or any other kind of thing that I do not permit, then the feeling power has, in its negative form, the ability to switch off the cognitive drive. It can actually kill positivity of the will. It can make a relation impossible. So that we find in many people this idea that something is wrong, antisocial, not permissible, can so impede the positive feeling of delight, so cover it with guilt and the fear of social censure, that it actually has the power to turn off the positivity of the cognitive drive, and the person then becomes devoid of willpower. And in the same way, the drive power itself, which derives its energy from food, from solar and cosmic radiation, this drive power has a nice habit of ignoring the individual to which it is working. You know very well that in the case of all those forces in us which are not peculiar to any given individual, like the desire to eat food, the desire to belong to a herd, the desire for sexual relations, we can't really call these forces confined to a given individual. We find them all over the place. So we have to say that they are super individual forces. These super individual forces function through us. They're connected with cosmic forces, with solar forces, some of them getting into us through eating food, others by direct radiation from the sun and so on. Certainly all these forces are super individual cosmic forces in their origination. But they do not have regard for the individual purpose of that being. And consequently, that drive power, that cognitive urge, that cosmic insertion of power, can disturb feeling power. So that one may have a feeling that something is nice or not nice, and the drive power coming in may say, it is a matter of no importance whether it's nice or not nice, it must be done. So that regardless of the aesthetics of the situation, the drive power will say, do this. And the aesthetic sense may say, no, no, it's not nice. Grandmother wouldn't have done it, and she was well brought up. And the drive power says, well, she's anachronistic, and we will proceed to do it. So the drive power can disturb the feeling power. And if the feeling power, which could have evaluated the situation aesthetically, being driven by the super individual cosmic force, is disturbed, overthrown, and then proceeds to fool about with the ideas, as in the first case we considered of the feeling power biasing the idea power. Only now the feeling power itself is being determined by the super individual cosmic force, which has overthrown all aesthetic considerations, made violent yet himself two bears and the washerwoman's daughter, and has overthrown his idea of what constitutes an Englishman and a gentleman, and led him into certain cosmic relations that he would, as an individual, have avoided. Now, wherever two of these forces meet and are moving in opposite directions, because they are forces moving in opposite directions and meeting, we have a zone of turbulence. So we can see immediately that between the feeling power and the cognitive drive power, if there is opposition, if the drive power is moving up to express and the feeling power is moving down to try to inhibit, then between those two centers we experience turbulence. And we can see immediately that we have two main centers of turbulence here. One between the drive and the feeling, and one between the feeling and the idea. Now, if we say that roughly the feeling power is above the diaphragm and the drive power is below the diaphragm, then somewhere on the level of the diaphragm itself, say about the solar plexus level, we experience a peculiar kind of turbulence whenever the feeling tries to negate the drive power. We feel a kind of vortical spin and a peculiar sensation of loss in the solar plexus, and the voice like the demon of Socrates saying, know. Remember that the demon of Socrates used to say nothing until it was time to say no, and then it spoke. Well, it's like D.H. Lawrence saying, I always trust my solar plexus. Anybody engaging in any work of art, if he feels very carefully and he starts to put a brush mark down, if that brush mark is wrong, you feel a slight sinking sensation in the region of the solar plexus. A little bit of centering on this zone gives rise to a very good sense of what is and is not fitting. The drive power is trying to express itself, and the feeling part is saying, no, no, that's excessive. That's the wrong direction. It's saying something not nice about it and trying to stop it. And it registers in the solar plexus. And the same way, between the feeling power and the idea power, on the level with the throat, one has another zone of turbulence, where the feeling power is trying to do one thing, and the idea power is trying to do the opposite. And this invariably produces the sensations in the throat of tension, of constriction, and so on. You may notice that before you're about to cry, you often get what you call a lump in the throat, and you feel a definite movement of the larynx. This is the result of the conflict between the feeling and the idea. It may be that the feeling says to you, burst into tears, and the idea says, no, don't do that, because you're in the public and they'll think you're a bit of a fool. So the idea is saying no to the tears, and the feeling is saying yes to the tears, and the result is a funny feeling around the larynx. So wherever two forces they produce a zone of turbulence if they are moving in opposite directions. Now, from the level at which this turbulence appears, we can say which of the two forces is winning. Now, if we had to number in order of ontological importance, the importance of being, the three levels, we would have to say that the feeling power, the central feeling power, is prior. We have to say, that is number one, like number one in the feeling level. Now that is because, absolutely prior to any specific behavior, or form of power, whatever, that is the field of power which is infinite. So that the feeling, the field awareness, which is infinite, is absolutely prior to any specific form or action of it. So we write number one at the heart level in the feeling center, and this means field power is absolutely prior to all its manifestations. Now we've got to write number two. Will it be drive or idea? This is number two. There's been a lot of debate about this for a few thousand years, but a little logic unbiased by feeling can help us. The field power, unmobilized, produces absolutely nothing whatever. But at the point of mobilization, it has the name of initiation, or drive, or urge. And therefore we have to say number two is the drive power. First the field, then the mobilization of the field. The field starts to move. Jacob Burman says, the soul gives the lift, nature executes. This means to say that the whole field of nature is a power, and that if from an individual center there is the starting of a direction at all, that is the movement we call cognition, then it will lift it, just as water is lifted by the air blowing on the surface of the sea. And once that initial lift has occurred, by the law, it will fall again. Can't lift and go on lifting uniformly, because that will take the whole of infinity with it. Well, it does, if there's a finite application of power, of course, there's a lift, and then the lift drops, every wave press has a trough, and then a ripple starts from the center of initiation. Nature is executing. So the form of the lift is the form that nature will propagate. Number one is the feeling awareness, the field awareness. Number two is the mobilization of the field awareness, which is the appearance of drive inclination, primary urge, and so on. But as soon as this force starts mobilizing and running along, by the very nature of finite energy expenditure, it rotates. It is moving in a field into a resistance. When two forces come into opposition, the result is a rotation. So number three, then, is the idea, the form. Idea means form. The third thing is form. So then we can say, absolutely prior is the field power, which is sensed simply as feeling without a contour, infinite field awareness. This then mobilizes itself, lifts itself up in a certain characteristic way by expenditure of energy, lets itself go, and it falls, and the continuum round it, the field round it, must do the same. So nature, the field, executes the form of the decision of the will. And as it's going along, it spins round by the very nature of forces in opposition. But rotating is circumscription, and circumscription is idea. And so the idea is the third level of evolution from the field. Now, if we like to change the numbers of these, which we can do, we could say as absolutely prior, the first is the field, and we should call it zero. Because zero is nothing at all, it's that which is before the unity of the one. But even zero is drawn with a circle, so it won't do. So we write this circle zero, and then we rub it out. And that is the infinite field. And then the next thing we write is one. So that's really two. And it's the first thing, the mobilization, the unity of the drive, down here, is already the second ontological order, but the first temporal order. Remember, the first is head of a series. And the time is serial. So the first impulse that generates the time is the head of the temporal series, and it's called first. Prior to this, there is only the eternality of the infinite field. And to be aware of the reason why we say zero instead of one, and one instead of zero, and two instead of one, and three instead of two, and so on, can help to clarify some mystical, occult, alchemical symbols, where these things are not always stated too clearly. But quite simply, to represent infinity, we shouldn't write anything at all. As we must make a mark to let us know that we're thinking about nothing, we have agreed to draw a circle, which is something, and say, rub it out. Then we've agreed to put a vertical stone, call this one, and this one, funnily enough, is an LME, it's another circumscription. It is a finite and the first of a series. The word first, the FRST, function in it, and the word fourth, where the FRTH function is the same. Both mean fire, they mean energy. But the first one means the head of the series, and the fourth one means the externally manifested, which has gone forth. Now, the feeling awareness is absolutely prior, ontologically, and then it mobilizes itself as a drive power, and this drive power then circulates and produces ideas. Now, the ideas, by repeated ingestion of power, gradually become made gross. They are gross by packing energy into them. Cosmic energy inserted by the sun through food into organisms. But it is simply cosmic energy force inside a form. The form is simply the way that the connective drive has mobilized itself, and the connective drive is simply the absolute field self-mobilizing. In yoga terminology, there are three states of being and a non-state beyond. And we can call these the subtle and the gross. And the turiya, that which is beyond the. Now, if we say the causal, from the use of the word causal, cause, strike, the causal must be the moment of strike, that is the point of initiation, the
that mobilization of the field force. Cause means strike. And there is no strike in the field considered abstractly as infinite field. And
at the precise point where we consider the field to mobilize itself, lift itself up, and the lifting up punches into the infinite continuum and acts in that punching as a cause. So we say the causal level is the drive power or will. But the phase following the causal power is the idea. And the idea is simply the form. And this idea world, this formal world then, is called the subtle world. The causal world, that's the world of will, the subtle world, the world of ideas, the gross world, the world of mass inertia packed into the form. Remember, there is no matter other than masses of forces. These forces are condensed, packed into the form, that is, into the idea. And as they're packed in, the idea then becomes gross. It has mass inertia. So it goes causal, that is the conative drive, subtle, that is deviational level, gross, that is your food body, mass inertia. But the form is the absolute, the prior one that was the first. That is to say, the absolute infinite field is that force that lies beyond, if you count, will or conative drive in number one. So, as we start ordinarily in practice with an effort of will, if we say the first step to realization, because first means end of the series, is an act of will, the will to understand. When we make this first act of will, we have released the cause. This then proceeds to ideate, that is to formulate itself, and then it proceeds to ingest energy into it, to absorb food, and to pack itself and become mass inertia. And thus, one, the drive power, two, the idea power, subtle world, three, the gross world, and four, beyond it, is the field again. And on the other hand, if we start with the gross materialist, we could say, let us start with the known, pass from the known to the unknown. Which is always very amusing, because the materialists always start with the gross physical body and call it the known. And they actually believe they're passing from the known to the unknown when they go from the gross material body to an idea. But in fact, they have no awareness whatever of the gross physical body, other than a form of resistance. A force. But because of the materialistic bias and their desire to eliminate intelligence from the universe, they pretend that they are starting from the known in the gross material world, which in fact is no more than a complex of sense impressions. And they go from that and count gross world 1, idea world 2, causative will world 3, and then the beyond, materia again. Beyond is number 4. Number 4 is still the field. So it doesn't matter which end we start at, whether we start at the conative end, will number 1, or whether we start gross world number 1, the fourth one is always the same one, namely the field. Field awareness is absolute to the first force, and first and fourth are both derived from the same root, and both of them mean fire. And fire is a symbol of energy, which is precisely this energy which is expressing itself in work and end, and is really the absolute power itself. So from this we see that in practical terms for exercise, what we have to do is watch our organism on its threefold level, threefold function, and if we have a feeling, deliberately, because we know it must be abstract, if we haven't got an idea and a cognitive drive with it, deliberately feel for the drive tendency in the feeling, and deliberately allow the feeling to clarify itself as idea. And if we have an idea, and we can't feel it, like a mathematical idea 2 and 2 is 4, and we cannot find a creative drive about it, it simply means we're not looking carefully enough, and our duty to ourselves is to get hold of the idea and feel whether we like it or not, and then feel how much energy is pushing this idea. And when we get hold of a cognitive drive, which is stupid individual, we deliberately try to feel why it is pointing in one direction rather than another, and in so doing, we pass from the feeling to the idea, and we see that this cognitive drive is actually pushing through individuals in order to propagate certain forms. In other words, the cognitive drive has its biological preferences. Now, if we do this threefold exercise, we are making ourselves more concrete, more whole, more grown together. Concrete means grown together, and it's another way of saying integrated. And of course, integration of being is the same thing as the substantialization of the self and the growth of the awareness of the possibility of immortality, that is, integration, resistance to breaking, resistance to being disintegrated. And if we can get hold of this threefoldness of our being, we have the power, if we wish, to resist disintegration to a remarkable degree. In fact, if we get hold of it properly, we have absolute power to become immortal. And things against it, of course, are the mass inertia of the mnemic traces, all the things that have happened and been rammed into us, we could call them plasma grams if we wanted, the experiences of our ancestors passed through the continuity of the protoplasm to us. All these experiences are driving us to believe in death, driving us to believe that we must disintegrate when we've done our 3-4 years and 10 years ago. And this kind of inertia is causing our cognitive urge to give up at a certain point, which is causing our feeling level to become negative where it could become positive. The greatest amount of tyranny is actually exercised at the ideal level. You see, the cognitive drive is rather a funny thing. It's very, very hard to abuse it. It's very hard to abuse the sex instinct itself. It's very hard to abuse sexual activity, because once it is expended, it doesn't start again until it's built up again. Now, it is not a question of abusing sex, because you can't do that. But an idea can abuse your body quite easily. It can drive you to wear your muscles down. It can drive you to do all sorts of silly things. But it is not sex that is being abused. It is simply the organism. Sex, once discharged, is discharged, and that's the end of that. There isn't any more to abuse for the time being. But you can abuse the organism by forcing it through idea patterns, through concepts that one should be able to do X, whatever X might mean. And this idea that one should be able to do certain things may release energy, influence the feeling, determine a kind of cognitive pseudo drive to force the body beyond its proper limits. The whole thing consists really in the recognition of the absolute non-duality of the power of the field. This infinite field of power mobilizes within itself spheres of force. Each sphere of force is an individual. The universe is a big individual, and within it there are many little universes. And each sphere of force acts as an individual and is threefold. It is formed and therefore an idea being. It is aware of the field of its action and therefore is a feeling being. And it is a certain mobilization of force and therefore it is a cognitive being. To become aware of this, to make ourselves feel, think, and urge simultaneously is the aim. The baby does it without knowing that it's doing it, or it gets stuck. The baby's action is perfect. Like the Tao Te Ching says, the baby can cry all day without getting tired, because the baby's idea and feeling and urge are not out of harmony. But once this harmony has been destroyed by the inroads of educational stimuli, then it takes a lot of work to regain the state that the child had unconsciously, only this time consciously. The point is that if we do manage to gain the level the child had unconsciously, only consciously, we do not have to relinquish it again. We can deliberately maintain this threefold activity within ourselves, in which case our evolution as individuals can be said to be finished.
clarify something from a few weeks ago. Talking in a similar vein regarding the feeding of the three senses, where the gross material is fed with gross material food, and feeling was fed by tuning into feelings, and idea by tuning into ideas and truth. If you gave some examples where you could get two ideas and by emoting about these ideas and pushing them together, you could produce a new emergence. Then we spoke about feelings, where you said, all right, you take a feeling of love, which is the feeling for developing the potentials, or the feeling of hate, which was love deprived of its object. And you directed this against a similar feeling in another being. Now this was prior to saying you did this internally at a higher level than yourself.
Yeah.
If you directed this against a similar feeling in another being, again you've got a new emergence. Mm-hmm. Now I wonder if you can clarify what you mean here by directing this feeling against a similar feeling in another being.
Yes. Well, we've said that love actually is God, that is the absolute power. As an absolute, it cannot be thought in, and therefore it remains love. But at the finite level, where it functions finitely by deliberate mobilization in a finite manner, it exposes itself to the possibility of being thwarted. Now, if we say the law of alignment of force, I put an answer. The force is trying to get to the place X, but I put a wall between the force and the object X. And the force hitting the wall turbulates. And that turbulation is hate. And further, we actually find that we have said something that's put a wall up to another person. And we see that their love, that is their direction towards the object that they have, is now thwarted by the form we've put up. We can reactively try to justify ourselves for producing this hate. We can justify the wall we've put up reactively. Or we can just as reactively be afraid of this turbulence we've caused and apologize and withdraw the obstacle. Now, whether we hit back reactively, as without control, or suddenly go quiet and retract our damaging, obstructing remark, if it is negative, it is not the best thing for us. But if somebody is rushing towards a target and we insert an obstacle and they then turbulate, if we remain positive in the situation and we see that they are hitting us like mad, for stopping them, we can produce a new emergent either by deliberately, freely converting the obstacle to an end by redefining it, or we can deliberately pile the obstacle up and make it thicker and thicker so that the person actually hits very, very hard against the obstacle and reacts more violently than it would otherwise have done. In this case, we are consciously and deliberately opposing the force, and therefore we are acting in a hate-creating manner. But if we are doing it deliberately, we are forcing a new emergence in the consciousness of the person we are opposing. And likewise, we are presenting ourselves as some new emergence in the new behavior pattern of this person whom we are opposing. Now, it doesn't really matter whether we do it with going with them in the way or opposing them, providing we do it freely. If we're doing it non-reactively and extremely, we can always stop if we find that the fellow is blowing the fuse, if we're really sensitive, and we can take it up to the point where he's become aware of something in himself that previously he would not have known about, would not have admitted. So that we can actually present an obstacle to a dear friend, we start to prove a point. And when he gets really mad at us, instead of withdrawing us and apologizing, we can deliberately and consciously support the obstacle with other concepts. We can make the obstacle bigger and better until we can flatten him completely, so that he cannot even conceive the possibility of getting the object. And this causes his turbulence to go through various phases of characterization, and he exhibits all sorts of funny ideas. And then when you think he's sufficiently turbulated to have given birth to a good idea, then you can remove the obstacle. So smile when you call me busy. This is the principle that William Blake called opposition is too offensive, meaning free willed opposition. With love, that is, with the will to develop potential, is too offensive. Offensive is that which frees one. And more damage is actually being produced in the world by negative failure to oppose an erroneous idea than there has been done by deliberate opposition. In the case of feeding an idea, it's fairly obvious inside your own head. You can force an idea to turn into another idea by emoting about it.
Yes,
I
understand that.
A young art student the other day said he wasn't very good at drawing the third dimension in figures. She was in despair about it and thought she'd never be any good at doing that. She couldn't see three dimensions. That is obvious that she couldn't feel mine. So I said, if you emote about the idea of 3D, then you will get the feeling of what 3D means. And I said, now imagine I am sawing over your eyebrow through the skull. Close your eyes and feel that I'm sawing. And she immediately felt uncomfortable. And a feeling of three dimensions appeared in her skull. And she discovered that she really could feel which part of her forehead was being sawn first. And as this imaginary saw went through, how when it got over the temporal bones, it was cutting a wider line than it was right at the front. In other words, she found herself able to draw a scene from a saw cut, the shape of her own skull. She had got it by emoting about it. Now, if we remember that we said about the sense of idea or form, it is largely the product of the visual sense, presenting us with a retinal patch of tone or colour and the circumscribing line around it. And therefore, by repression of the feeling into a native aspect, it has tended to be two-dimensional, that is, merely a retinal flat image. If you want to get the two-dimensional one, we must introduce the emotive pronative aspects into it. And then it gives birth to just what we want. So we can actually cause our own organism to respond by pushing it in one of the three ways and feeding it by giving it its appropriate food. But most important of all is the gaining of the courage to tell the truth to somebody, even if it's going to be unpleasant, but not to feel unpleasant in the telling.
It's very difficult, isn't it?
It's very hard because one expects trouble. And the tendency is to defend against the possible trouble and possibly to justify having said this unpleasant truth. As if perfect balance is done, it is possible actually to tell the truth and feel that the truth is better to know. We usually find that if we get hold of this feeling properly and the person has received a truth that is unpalatable, this person will actually accept the truth from us in this moment of presenting it, because it is presented truthfully. But we must not be surprised if when we've gone out of the room, the energy that was inhibited in that person by what process he does not know, as soon as we've gone out of the room, we'll buttonhole somebody and proceed to try to restate the old position.
Don't you find that the majority of people who assume themselves to be at the same level as the people they're talking to, are they reluctant to accept anything from the other beings on the ground that they're just as capable of coming to a judgment which is really an opinion? But they may take a truth from someone to whom they go for advice or to whom they look to as being having more understanding. it means really to be able to do this. You've got to be so clear internally that you not only know what the truth is yourself, but you also act upon it. And this, to my mind, eliminates the majority of us from being in a position to present this to other people.
Yes, but there's another point. There's not only the presenter, but there is a receiver of the presenting. And if a man wants to evolve and accelerate his own evolution, he has a duty to himself to take the truth from wherever it comes, whether it's from a so-called acceptable source or not. Because the fact is that the world's philosophy is at work, very strongly trying to persuade men not to listen to men, generally, in public. And in the same way, it produces tensions between women. And the man who really wants to move will talk to a congenital idiot to see what idiots think about it, and say this is a valid point of view, the idiot's point of view. And he will assimilate this, knowing that by the laws of logic, he can invert this idiot's view into a true view.
Yes, it is obvious that the person who is wanting to find out is really going to be the only person who's going to be affected in that case, isn't it?
Yes.
To present a truth to a person already convinced of the righteousness of their own behaviour may have an effect in the long run, but it's going to meet a sort of immediate opposition from the presentation.
Yes, but to any person who says, this has happened to me many times, X has come to me and said, I don't mind being told by Y, but I do object strongly to being told by Z.
Yes, yes.
What? 2 and 2 is 4. I'm not going to hear it from Z, but I will accept it from Y. Well, of course, obviously the thing to say is 2 and 2 is 4, wherever it comes from. And if you want to learn very, very quickly, take it wherever it comes. Because it doesn't really matter whether the fellow who says it knows what he's talking about. One of the biggest clowns I know has a marvelous memory. And he has memorized the Tao Te Ching and the Bhagavad Gita and the Signature of Rerum's main passages verbatim. And he has actually introduced and converted a large number of people to the study of these things, and he knows nothing about it. And it doesn't really matter that he knows nothing about it to him, because he didn't want to know something about it. He just liked the jingle and the effect of the jingle on what he thought were intellectuals. But in a group of intellectuals, you often find a few serious people. And they listen and they pick this stuff up. And initially they may be duped into thinking this fellow actually knows something about what he's talking about. And he doesn't. And they may find out that he doesn't. But if they have learned the lesson of the words that he uttered, they won't mind that he doesn't know and doesn't want to know. They'll just be glad that he was a kind of telephone record or tape record that happened to be on when they were about. And they won't rail against him any more than they would against the telephone record with some interesting scientific data. The thing is to be able to take the bread wherever it comes, and not to allow that funny world's philosopher to stop the acceptance of information from an assumed, at least a declared assumed inferior source. Especially as most often it is not a question of the person who is saying the thing being unwilling to say it, so much as the eye of a third or fourth person watching that is determining how the question shall be put and what effect shall be had in public in making the question. Really, the whole thing depends on the learner. And therefore, in ancient systems, whether we take the mysteries of the Greeks or the Egyptians or the Yogis, we find the old statement that there must be the right pupil for the right teacher. Because the right teacher can't do much with the wrong pupil. And certainly the right pupil will find the right teacher, even if he has to go through a million wrong teachers first, because he will keep questioning. And the inconsistencies of the wrong teacher will show themselves. And if they are wrong, he should be very, very glad that he's been shown that mode of being wrong, because if he did not see it and work through it, he might, at some later date, be presented with the same error while he's off guard in this world. So we could say in this sense that practically everything depends on the learner. And we see this in the doctrine of grace, in theology. Because it says that God is going to confer his grace upon people willingly by his arbitrary will. And yet, in a very peculiar way, he won't do it unless the person wants it. Because that would be imposing something on a person that they didn't want, imposing on their free will and reducing them to puppets, which is the mystery of grace. The learner must want to learn, and this is the precondition of the learning. And the toughest teacher in the world can't make a non-learner learn. He can't do so, because if he's teaching in the name of free response, he cannot require from a non-learner a learning response. So then if anybody isn't learning, they should really say, this is my own fault, because I'm setting up the obstacles to my learning process, usually by some individual antipathy.